Members, I call the Environment and Natural Resources Finance and Policy Committee to order. I see that a quorum is present. I want to highlight a couple of things. We are going to take up the minutes from our last meeting Thursday, and I want to also note that in your packets, there is a copy of the rules. This was distributed by an email earlier today as per House Rule 6.21. They're pretty straightforward. I've talked to Lead Fisher, and if there is anything that members want to visit with me on relative to the rules, as always, it's an open door policy. We're going to go ahead and get started with the first order of business for today. DNR is here with an overview that'll be followed by a overview from Bowser. Assistant Commissioner Bob Meyer, if you would like to go ahead and introduce yourself for the record, the committee is ready to hear your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon. For the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources. I have with me today John Waters, our Government Relations Supervisor. He's been in this role for several years now. He's running our, I call it our ground operations here at the Capitol, but you'll see him here on a day-to-day basis working with the committees and staff, getting us prepared for the committee's desires. So with us today, we're going to provide a brief overview of the agency, kind of our organizational layout, talk briefly about divisions, some of their key charges, and also leave time for questions if people have them. First, starting with our commissioner's leadership team, the DNR, as you are, know, Sarah Stroman's commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources, Barb Naramore, deputy commissioner, myself, assistant commissioner. I oversee the divisions of fish and wildlife, enforcement, also coordinate our government relations activities, and our tribal relations director reports to myself. Jess Richards, Assistant Commissioner for Ecological Water Resources and Lands and Minerals. And Shannon Lothammer, who's our Assistant Commissioner working with Parks and Trails, Forestry, and our Operation Management Budget Services. I also should say that within the Governor's Office, our tribal relations work is housed. Bradley Harrington, our Tribal Relations Director, reports directly to me, and underneath him, we've just in the past 6 months filled a Ojibwe relations manager and a Dakota relations staff person because of our interactions on a daily basis are just continuous with the tribes. Pretty much everything we do touches a tribe, and we are constantly, daily, hourly working with them and talking about issues related to natural resources management and other things as required under 1065. The mission of the DNR is to work with, and I repeat, with Minnesotans to conserve and manage the state's natural resources, to provide outdoor recreation opportunities, and to provide for commercial uses of natural resources in a way that creates a sustainable life. The reason I say with is because making sure that we're working closely with Minnesotans is a key to success, not only with citizens on a daily day-to-day basis, but with local units of government, cities, counties, townships, and everyone, legislators as well, making sure that we're all working together and understand our decisions. You can see these three circles that I use in this slide here, talking about the three pieces of our mission: outdoor recreation, economic development, and natural resource protection. And really in that shaded area there is where I think most of the best work that the department does takes place, understanding people's needs related to natural resource protection, economic development, outdoor recreation, how they all fit together. You look right now, any one of our sport, outdoor winter activities, snowmobiling, biking on trails, or ice fishing, cross-country skiing, they have a piece of that on each part of those circles there. So that's really where we like to focus, if at all possible or when possible. Our administrative regions are focused throughout the state in four areas. Northwest, Region 1, our central office is in Bemidji. Our regional manager, Ben Berge, coordinates the activities there. Region 2, Northeast Minnesota, central offices in Grand Rapids there, regional office in Grand Rapids, Minnesota. Shelley Patton is our director. Region 3, our central region, Grant Wilson is the director. They're currently housed down off of Warner Road. And Region 4, out of New Ulm, is a vacant. Scott Reimold was with us for a long period of time. If you've seen Scott, you cannot forget him with the hat and the mustache, but he has moved on to other conservation, important conservation work, and we're in the process of filling that position as well. These regional directors work throughout the region. For members outstate, they should be considered your point of first contact for administrative or other kind of day-to-day things. Obviously, otherwise, myself or John are certainly here to help assist with legislative questions or anything else that we can facilitate with. Talking a little bit about our footprint, we have 285 report to work sites statewide and recreational facilities in every county, a trail, a campsite, public water access, whatever is important to you as you're an outdoor person in Minnesota. We employ approximately 3,350 employees. If you looked at FTEs, that'd be about 3,100. Because of our fluid nature in our workforce during the summer seasons, those numbers do increase during the recreation shoulder seasons there. Also, we own over 2,900 owned or leased buildings. Now, these are not all office buildings. They may be an outhouse or a storage building, but they are buildings that we track through our facility asset management reporting and things that need to be taken care of along with other things. So we'd like to make sure that people understand of the building footprint that we have as well. Some of the things by the numbers that are important to people are state forests, 60 forests, aquatic management areas, 64 state parks, 9 state rec areas, and 9 state trails, 870 miles of state at grant and aid cross-country ski trails, 4,100 miles of hiking, biking, horse, and motorized trails within state park recreation areas and state forest lands. It's important to note those motorized trails within state parks are limited to snowmobile trails where the trails are appropriate and the conditions provide access. Also, just on the other side of the ledger there, over 1 million hunting licenses sold each year, angling licenses, I should say, 800,000 fishing or hunting licenses, 812,000 registered boats within the states. The list goes on and on. 1,700 public water access sites and 390 fishing piers, platforms, and shore fishing piers, and those numbers are growing as we continue. A little bit about our FY24-25 budget. This is a little skewed because of some of the one-time fundings that we did receive last biennium. It'll be closer to $1.3 billion for 26-27 as we talk about the governor's budget in the coming weeks. Spread across more than 50 funds, I think Brad Hagemeyer and his colleagues can contest our the DNR budget is one of the most complicated budgets that there is in state government, maybe outside of some of the other larger areas such as education or health care. But we do have a number of funds and a number of funding sources. Primarily operating funds come out of the natural resources funds or 13% of the funds there. Game and Fish Fund is 14%. The general fund makes up 30% of our budget in 24-25. You can see this is less than 1% of the state's general fund spending. A large amount of one-time funding comes into the department and leaves through the department from the legacy funds and the Environmental Trust Fund, Outdoor Heritage Fund, Parks Trails Fund, Clean Water Fund, LCCMR, are some of those funds that go through, that come through us there. And this is kind of important to realize, 22% of our budget is passed through to non-state entities. Travel treaty payments come through the DNR. PILT payments, we do the calculation for the Department of Revenue, then they send the money out. Things like that are a couple of those entities in that category. Now, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move through our divisional, kind of the organization, who our directors are, and some of the key things that they deal with. Starting with our Lands and Minerals Division, they were just here recently talking about the legislatively mandated gas technical advisory report that we presented. Joe Henderson, as the director, Mike Liljegren was here with you. Ted Anderson and Cheryl Kelly Dobie are assistant directors within that division as well. Managing our real estate activities for the 5.6 million acres of state-owned lands, which include the 2.5 million acres of school trust fund lands. administered 2,550 state land leases in calendar year 23. These could be anything from a trail lease to a recreational lease to individuals have leases for their properties or access agreements through the DNR as well that are managed through Lands and Minerals. And then the 12 million acres of state-owned mineral rights, and then also the mineral leasing program is managed through the Division of Lands and Minerals, 272 active mineral leases with 158 of those leases ongoing for non-ferrous exploration. I talked about our real estate transactions, the regulatory work and expertise we have on mineral exploration, mining and mine land reclamation, managing our payments and mineral valuation claims for the tax forfeit properties, which is a newly created responsibility from the legislature last session. Then also, as we talked about, they're responsible for leading the legislative charge on developing the regulatory framework for gas extraction. Moving on to the Division of Ecological and Water Resources, Katie Smith is our division director there. Assistant directors Melissa Kusky and Jason Meckel has recently been promoted to assistant director. He's been does a lot of our work with groundwater sustainability and the Clean Water Fund. You will see him in the coming weeks discussing those activities. In this division, our scientific and natural resource or scientific and natural area program is housed. We have over 100, and we have 170 actually SNAs right now, covering almost 200,000 acres. Our Prairie Bank easement program is housed here as well. Also, a large bulk of the state's side of aquatic invasive species work is done within EWR. 52,700 inspections conducted last year. And those are just state inspections, not the county or other lake watershed district inspections as well. Our groundwater appropriation program is housed here. On that number, 874, that's just new appropriations that we received. We manage thousands of groundwater appropriation permits throughout the state. And then also our network of groundwater observation wells. Really, they provide the critical information that we need, not only the state, but local governments, businesses, and landowners to foster natural resources stewardship, and also regulatory work. Our permit, public water works permit program, and some of those other programs are housed within the Ecological Water Resources Division as well. Moving on to forestry, Division Director Patty Thielen and Deputy Director Andrew Ahrens. Typically, we respond to over 1,000 fires annually. That's a five-year average. Last year, we responded to a lot more than that. The past couple years, we've had a lot of fire activity. Hopefully, we won't have an active fire season this year, but we'll see where things go. Managed the 60 state forests that we talked about, the lands encompassed in there. Provides about one-third of the fiber used across the state for our mills and hardwood operations that are out there. 30,000 acres of reforestation occurs annually on average. And then also working with, on average, 70,000 acres of private land. That's in private land management, getting them into stewardship plans and things like that. Also, a little known piece of what they do, but it's critically important, is taking care of our 2,400 miles of state forest roads that provide the groundwork or the network for our forest industries work on harvesting, reforestation, but also outdoor recreation activity. Grouse hunters, deer hunters, bird watchers, access to people's private property. This network of forest roads is critical to all of those things in northern Minnesota primarily. Moving on to the Division of Parks and Trails, Ann Pierce, our director, Deputy Director Phil Leversedge, as we talked about, 64 state parks, 9 state rec areas, 9 state waysides, and more than 5,000 campsites, 1.14 million overnight visitors in 2023. We operate small cities, as you all know, if you've been out there in the summertime, Itasca, St. Croix. Some of the larger ones literally are small villages of people having a lot of fun and doing what they're there to do, so we appreciate being able to do that. Plus the thousands of miles of biking, hiking trails, snowmobile trails, public water accesses, fishing piers, and then delivering our outdoor education, environmental education work, approximately 8,600 programs to over 200,000 participants each year. Our ICANN series throughout the parks is extremely popular. And also looking at how do we work with school districts and others in our No Child Left Inside grant program to expand these opportunities. is critically important. Moving on to the Division of Fish and Wildlife, Kelly Straka is our division director there. Pat Rivers, our deputy director, talked about the number of licenses sold, but over 1.5 million acres of wildlife management areas covering, or I should say 1,500 WMAs covering 1.3 million acres of land, managing 4,000 of our lakes actively for fishing. That's what we call the fishing lakes. And then our fish stocking, 1,370 lakes, 1,226 streams with trout. The work that we're doing ongoing with our fish hatcheries is great. They're still in pre-design and design work, but we anticipate construction to begin at Waterville Hatchery, which is one of our oldest but most important hatcheries, next year to fully develop and redevelop that facility. Managing fish and wildlife populations and providing related outdoor recreation opportunities, and also conserving and enhancing our water, land, habitats, and regulating that hunting, fishing, and trapping, some of the key attributes that go on in that division. Our enforcement division, Colonel Rodman Smith is the division director. Lieutenant Colonel Robert Gorecki is the deputy. We have 154 conservation officers in the field, or 154 districts. Then we also have approximately 50 people in supervisory, manager, and non-district, like our enforcement safety training officers. We have motorized vehicle specialty staff and things like that that provide the other part of that complement. 51,000 students certified annually in ATV, snowmobile, boat, and firearm safety programs. Still a core part of our mission within enforcement, providing that education safety. And the 2,500 documented contacts in 2024. Now, these weren't citations. They were interactions that we have many times on the water. If you're fishing, the officers may come by and say, can I see your licenses? And if you're fortunate enough to have your grandkids or children in your boat and they're wearing their life jackets, they'll give them a coupon for a ice cream cone or something like that. So it's really creating those contacts, those memorable contacts. That's really important, and people understanding that, hey, these folks are here to protect us, to make sure people are doing the right thing, not just coming down on people for doing the wrong thing all the time. Also working with over hundreds of organizations, our high school shooting sports league, our clay trap shooting facilities, and the program we have in Minnesota is by far one of the largest in the country and is a leader. I cannot stress enough the priority that we place on all aspects of the DNR, but particularly enforcement for disaster and emergency response. When someone is in trouble, these men and women will be there to protect and provide services for people. It helps myself sleep at night and help me know when I'm out recreating that we have a force of people out there trying to protect us and protecting us at all costs. Operations Service Division, Reno Solheid is our division director. Judy Smith's the deputy director. This is really the people who take care of everything. We talked about the number of buildings across the state. We have over 5,000 pieces of mobile equipment that we manage. Snowmobiles, ATVs, boats, tractors, trucks, trailers, you name it. These folks do a great job making sure everything is safe, well-managed, and there when we need it. It's going to start. It's going to be ready to go. No safety concerns. Also, the control, our work with Minute and our website. We have 64 million views of our DNR website on an annual basis. If you think about the people at the state fair, they coordinate our activities at state fair, the hundreds of thousands of people that we run into there. And we also have a phone or a 1-800 DNR number that they staff. And about 95,000 contacts a year, just with people who call 1-800 number, and it's staffed past 4:30 on a daily basis. So if people have a question, we do have people there to answer them and work with them on there. Supporting our staff through our human resources activity, emergency preparedness, disaster response are also housed in Operations Services Division, and then maintaining our fleet buildings, which is critically important. That was a high. Sorry if I rambled on way too long, but a high-level presentation, just some of the backdrop that we do to give you folks a flavor of how we're organized, where we're organized, and some of the things we do, Mr. Chair. As always, we can stand for questions.
Thank you, Commissioner. Member questions next. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. commissioner has an order over the water use in that area. We've hired a third-party vendor. Third-party vendor presented a specific timeline of events in order to interact with and engage specifically with local stakeholders. That process has been delayed, and the voices of the stakeholders, my constituents, have yet to be heard. Can you give me an update as to where that's at, and if the stakeholder engagement is going to be delayed, are we going to see an ultimate delay in informal decision making around the ultimate results from that third party vendor? And to what extent is the DNR committed to engaging with the people who live in that area to get their direct feedback so that we're basing this on science?
Assistant Commissioner Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Schultz, there's a lot of things there in that question. I'm going to kind of start at the end and work up if we can. We're completely committed to working with the residents and the citizens in that area and making sure that their voices are heard. The purpose of these groundwater management areas when we first developed them, the first one was the northeast metro area. We were facing challenges in White Bear Lake. Is to work with the people and to have them come up with ideas on how they should be conserving, using, sharing their water resources in that area. So that's obviously what we need to do. And people, suggestions are, we'll take any and all suggestions. We don't want it to become a last in, first out resource or things like that. We want communities and people who live in those areas to come up with the way that they should be responsibly managing those things. As far as the delays, I will need to get back to you on that information. But obviously, if there's a delay on the front end, we need to extend those timelines still on the back end. So we need to make sure that there's plenty of time there. And let me just, actually, Jason Meckel, as I was just talking about with an Ecological Water Resources, he and I will come back and talk to you more about that. I've been working with Commissioner Pop as well from the area. He's a member of the groundwater group, and he's been helping provide us with great kind of on-the-ground knowledge and resources as well.
Representative Schultz, any follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just on this topic specifically, the local folks who live there have yet to get direct engagement, which makes us concerned that this is being built on a model from St. Paul or some other place that doesn't have and doesn't take the information from the locals. So thank you for hearing that concern.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Assistant Commissioner. So at the end of session last year, we figured out a way to get the DNR a good amount of money to complete the public waters inventory and do there's a bill to reverse course on that, and I'm wondering what the progress report is that you can give us there. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Assistant Commissioner Meyer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Purcell, thank you for that, and thank you for the work last session and for your work and Representative Hansen's work in getting us the funds needed to do that. The main thing was for us to do that work, we were concerned that the funding wouldn't be complete, and we estimated that it's going to cost us about $1 million a year for 8 years to get the work done. That funding is still intact, and we will be working to keep that money there because we just hired five people to do this work. We estimated to take a team of five people doing 12 counties a year, 8 years to get the system updated. So our five FTEs are on the review team have been hired. We're working with Minute on a desktop tool, which hopefully will be delivered in March for testing and work on that. We're in the middle of working on tribal consultation. There are some bands who wanted to consult about this. They feel the public water inventory maybe shouldn't be included on reservations, so we're working through those issues. Developing a training plan with technical manual for the review team, and we're working on an announcement. I can't say when, but it'll, depending on when session ends, be done before session is over, on where we're going to start yet. A couple ideas we're looking at, you know, do we start with some of the work that was done in 2017 with some PWI removals, trout stream tributaries, and working with public drainage systems, but not the most difficult areas. So trying to figure out where do we start, begin to learn, and then move on from there. There are some couple bumpy spots throughout the state that we'll have to work through, and we'd like to get a little bit of experience under our feet before we get there. So we are still committed, we still have a process moving forward, and we will provide you updates when they come together.
Any other member questions? Representative Falconer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Assistant Commissioner. When you said that part of what you're working on is reforestation, I was just wondering if you have any idea how much of that is that to the benefit of logging industry? Is there more conservation kind of with a nod toward mature and old forest regrowth establishment in the state? Just kind of like where's the focus of the reforestation efforts? And how's that going?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Faulkner. By statute, we are mandatorily required to reforest after final harvest on a timber harvest. So that's our primary location, primary areas of focus where the funding that we seek is applied to. We're looking at reforestation activities and regeneration activities throughout the state forest system. A lot of it works on or we're taking a more closer look at what we are planting and where things are going to be growing in the next 50 years. So a resiliency kind of lens to it as we're working on, you know, our forests are successionally changing and making sure that we have the trees and adaptive species there to take that'll grow as we become warmer and drier. So primarily focused where reforestation activities have occurred, but also looking at the forest health. And how do we make sure that we maintain a successful and sustainable forest, not only in the years, but in the decades and decades to come? As we know, forests, we talk areas of 50, 100, 150 years rather than 5, 10, 15 years. So.
Lee Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Heintzman. Thank you, Assistant Commissioner Myers, for being here today in the presentation. The question I have is around the groundwater. I know we've got three groundwater management areas out there right now. Was kind of wondering is besides those areas, I know at one time there was a number of other areas in the state that were highlighted as possible going areas of concern. And I'm thinking back to a map that had been referenced before the committee about 12 years ago where it was showing different areas. And I was wondering, has there been any updates as to what's been happening with water allocation throughout the rest of the state? Do we still have these other areas of concern? Are they getting better? Are they getting worse? What's kind of happening in that realm?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Fisher, that's a great question for Jason Meckel.
No, I kind of figure that might be the situation.
We'll have to circle back with you on that because, you know, there's Straight River, some of those other ones there. Some have been done some work. Some have been kind of on hold. The Northeast Metro, we're still continuing to work through those issues. So let me pull together a short summary of our groundwater management activities for the committee, and we'll share that with folks.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you for the question.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner Meyer. In, I think, 2018, we had an aggregate task force, and nothing really happened with that. And then I think there was an audit review on the aggregate on that report. Just checking, have you or your team looked over that report and any recommendations on aggregate?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen. We have looked over the report. Some of those recommendations rely on funding, which are not contained within the governor's budget right now. But we can include our thoughts on some of those recommendations in our response back to the committee.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Meyer, I think you're aware of some massive aggregate mining proposals on Gray Cloud Island Township in the Mississippi River of digging a hole in the Mississippi River for 25 years to mine aggregate. Just any comments from the DNR on the wholesome proposal for Gray Cloud Island?
Commissioner Meyer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, I don't have any off the top of my head that I would reluctantly put into the record since I don't know, but I know our staff have been actively engaged working with your constituents, Army Corps of Engineer, reviewing those projects, and we can provide a brief update and a response back.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then finally, I've had some constituents that have been reporting abandoned boats where people just let the boat go and sink the boat. And, you know, it may have gasoline or oil or other things that are in rivers or lakes. Any comments, or have you looked at that issue at all?
Commissioner Meyer.
Chairman, Representative Hansen. Yes, I've been in conversations with other people who have those boats in their district as well. The large thing that's been brought to people's attention actually is on the St. Croix on the Wisconsin side. So we've been communicating with Wisconsin DNR and County Sheriff, St. Croix County Sheriffs as well. Our enforcement staff is aware of those things. It's a little bit different when they happen on inland waters or smaller lakes, or when they have less cost of disposal, I'll put it that way. I know there is some discussion, and perhaps you're involved with us, on strengthening state laws on those abandoned boats, and it's one that we are interested in, what would like to be a part of that conversation as well.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. That's something you and I might be working on together to see if there's something we can do on that. Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Chair Heinzman. And thank you, Commissioner, for the second overview. I love that we've got to take a deep dive into the DNR's top priorities and things that are happening. I've gotten a lot of calls in regards to snowmobiles and snowmobiling, the trail grant and aid program. So between like the decreased snowfall that we have here in Minnesota, and the cost of snowmobiles and our license, all the fees that have gone up, what's the DNR saying? What's your message to the local clubs, things like that? What can you say to our snowmobilers that are hurting right now?
Commissioner Meyer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilman, I feel the same way because I'm one of them, right? And I was at the MinUSA a day on the Hill talking with some of those folks, and we're down 40% of our renewals for the year have not been taken up just because there's no snow. A lot of people won't register their snowmobile until, hey, I can use it finally, so let's go. I'll register it since it is a three-year cycle. We're actively talking with the clubs on how can we operate more efficiently, how do we deal with the revenue. I don't have any good answers, but just communication and I was going to say commiseration, but that's something we share all along, no matter what. But working with the clubs and understanding their needs, how can we share equipment? How can we share responsibilities more? Hoping that we have a big snow year and the account comes back, but it is very cyclical, like a lot of our other, just like fishing licenses. When we have the weather's not good on Memorial Day or 4th of July weekend, falls in the middle of the week or something, you can see it in our license sales. Unfortunately, snowmobiles are the same way. Now, luckily, right now, there's a little bit more snow up in northern Minnesota than the rest of the state. So they are doing okay, but still, it was a half of a season, right? So not only the registrations, but all of the businesses that rely on it, the resorts, mom and pop, gas stations, restaurants, all of those things. So I wish I had a better answer for you, but trying to work through their concerns and making sure that we all understand what the concerns are and try to work together is the key thing.
Representative Gilman.
Thanks. I just have one quick follow-up. Thank you for that. Also, after the fish kills that happened in a lot of our lakes in my district and other surrounding areas, have you seen the population come back up? And have things been, doing better this past summer compared to the past year when we had so many lakes that hadn't had a fish kill in years, had fish kills happen?
Commissioner Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, it's too early to tell on some of those things, but definitely we'll be in contact, continue talking about that. What we're seeing is due to the low water levels, low oxygen levels, and the heat over the summertime, we were having a lot more algae blooms go on. I was working with a couple in Representative Gelman's district, but also throughout the state over the course of the summer, and yeah, hopefully we can balance those back out again a little bit more.
Okay, thanks.
Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair Hansen. And Commissioner, for your presentation. I'm curious, just following up on work that we did in the last biennium, we had more than $10 million, I think. You'll have to forgive me for forgetting exactly some of that money. I know went to Met Council, but $10 million at least for tree planting in Minnesota, and I would love to hear how much of that money has gone out the door, what the plans are for it. to Representative Falconer's question, you know, we should be doing that's money on top of our statutory reforestation. That's one of our powerful tools in fighting climate change, which maybe we can get some of that snow back. So I'd love to hear what's happening with that money.
Commissioner Meyer.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative. I'm just trying to go through my notes because we do have several shade tree grant programs or trade tree grant programs that are going on. We're in the process of closing out $1 million that was from 2020 to 2024. But I think specifically you're talking, you mentioned the $10.6 million bond funds for the shade tree program. So on that program, we received $16.8 million in requests. We've let out some of those dollars, but the bulk of them are on hold due to a legislative inquiry to the OLA on criteria that we're using to justify environmental justice areas, I believe, and some of those other language in the bill. So those grants are on hold until the legislative auditor provides us more direction.
Representative Finke.
Well, I have many follow-ups, thank you, Chair, to that last point that you made, but I will save them and take them offline. I won't make a speech about trees, but I'd love to get that money out for people to have the benefits of trees in their streets, in the tree canopy and everything we know it's doing, and I would like to learn more about that holdup. So I'll talk to the OLA's office, and if anyone has information, I'd love to hear that.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just for the record, there's a common interest around trees. We all love trees, and it's a good thing to have trees across our state. Quickly, Assistant Commissioner, a fun conversation for you. I'm going to leave it relatively open-ended for you. When you take a look at the most popular wildlife populations for the purposes of hunting, how are we doing along the lines of wildlife management, proper wildlife management, and what challenges, if any, exist that this legislature should address?
Commissioner Meyer.
Trying to figure out what the most popular wildlife is.
Representative Schultz.
No.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I'm just going to focus on deer hunting for our deer population. Our deer harvest was up from last year about 10% in the northern part of the state. Basically, from your district and Representative Nelson's district to Representative Juarez and Representative Burkle's district. Well, we need Scrabble over here, too, because he's on the arrowhead. But the deer population is a little bit different than what we see down in southern Minnesota. So we saw the population come back a little bit, what we saw from 2 years ago when we had the heavy snow. Now, since that was 3 years ago, I should say, we've had two kind of mild winters, so I'm seeing the deer come back a little bit up in northern Minnesota. We still have challenges there just with getting them back, making sure a lot of it was bucks only in some areas, things like that. But then you take that and then you look at the recently released deer depredation report from the Department of Agriculture. I know I've spoken with Representative Burkle about this. And down in Representative Jacobs' district, I mean, there are people who have way too many deer, right? And we have to figure out how do we deal with that issue in a sustainable, conservation-minded approach, but also making sure that the farmers have the relief that we need. So it's all relative, kind of, right? We're in the middle of our deer mandate, our five-year midpoint deer plan review. I can say the numbers I'm seeing continue to improve in northern Minnesota, but it ebbs and flows, right? Just like a natural system. So people are still deer hunting. A lot of people are still deer hunting. We didn't see a real decline there. The other challenge, you know, that some people will say is the wolf population. The wolf population ebbs and flows with our wildlife population as well. So that some people will say have an impact. They've been living together, deer and wolves, for a long time. If you look at my friends in the Arrowhead over in the Voyageurs National Park area, that's been bucks only for decades, right? I still see people go deer hunting. They still have their shacks. They still harvest a lot of nice deer, but it's part of the ecosystem. So we're working through those issues, and our management plans hopefully address some of those things. And, you know, as Representative Gilman wants more snow, and I want more snow. The deer probably don't want that much snow, and, you know, it's working throughout the whole system. How do we provide the relief opportunity for populations to grow in certain areas while also looking at the population? How do we manage it in other areas? So I wish it was really viable to capture deer in one area to move them, but we aren't going to be doing that ever. So we have to manage these populations kind of separately as well. So it's a long story. A lot of different pieces on that conversation, however you want to look at it. So.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I like hearing that we're not moving Cervidae. On the General Andrews forest in my area, that used to be a big, used to do a lot of planting and nursery there. Is there any plan to ever bring that back, or are you kind of moving up more towards Bemidji, or?
Commissioner Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, we just recently released a report or submitted a report to the legislature. I'll make sure you get a copy about it, of that. That was carried in the supplemental bill last year. Talks about reopening that facility. It does have a purpose. At the time that it was closed, we weren't seeing as much interest in reforestation activity as we are right now. It's more of a hardwood type facility, but it's unique to the fact that don't take this the wrong way. It has a closer job market than Bedora Nursery does. Even though it's over by Willow River State Forest area, there's still a larger workforce there than what we see up in that Park Rapids area where Bedora is, which is one of the challenges we see. Also, we do want to move with the legislature's support or continued support to containerize stock at some point in time. They last longer, they're easier to grow, and that would be one possibility at that facility. Or looking at the two of them together, how do we operate a two-facility nursery and what specializes in what? Bedora is going to be great when it gets up and running. We won't no longer need the duct tape and bale wire to run the facility, but you know, General Andrews would require significant resources to get that up and running as well. So,
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you go back to slide 7, the budget, the pie chart? I have some questions about this. Is this this is the money coming into the department, not the money being spent in the department? Is that right?
Yeah. So this, Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Representative Purcell, this is a snapshot by fund of our 24-25 biennial budget that was passed.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you. So that's the money going to the DNR, not how the DNR is spending the money?
Coming in, and a lot of this goes out as funding pass-throughs and things like that.
Okay.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my question is, how much of certain fees for certain things, like state park passes or licenses, how much of those like go directly into the fund that then that's the fund where the money is spent as well? And I guess those are the two I can think of, but of course there's obviously a million different things that the DNR does.
Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sure, and I'll do the best I can to answer that. Otherwise, we'd love to follow up and just spend some time with you talking about it as well. If you look at the bottom of this chart, that looks like a piece of art kind of or something with these little funds in there. Those are the natural resources funds. You take those in the game and fish fund, the big gray part are going to be federal funds we receive, but those are where people pay the DNR to do things. Your state park permit, your state park camping ground, state firewood, if you buy firewood or rent a boat, those all go into specific accounts in a natural resources fund. They're all specifically identified what the purposes are and what can and can't be done, basically what can be done with them. So, for example, the state park account, that's where revenues from daily and annual passes would go, and camping fees possibly. I'm not sure exactly on that. And then they have specific statutory uses for that. For example, another one would be the water rec account. So water recreation account has specific statutory uses on what those dollars can and can't be used for. Most accounts are set up that way in statute, so there's not – even our general fund has ties to it, or rider language, technical term, right? So most of, I'd say all of the funds that people are paying us with an expectation of having a service delivered or being able to do something are for those specific purposes. Now, people have tried to change those purposes or use them for other things, and that's where the legislature or things happen, right? Auditor and stuff. We're very, fund integrity is first and foremost on our mind, as well as supplement supplanting when it talks about legacy or LCCMR funds. So making sure that all the funds that we receive are being used for their intended purposes is something that we watch. It's first and foremost on our mind. We can come by and talk more about those specific accounts if you'd like. So.
Members, I have Representative Hansen, Representative Fisher, and Representative Jordan up next. Representative Hansen. Representative. Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Assistant Commissioner, the one thing, and it got triggered when I heard from Representative Schultz, is on CWD, what is happening with the management of the area? I know we had the southwest or the southeast portion of the state. I know we've had some areas where we've had some new instances where we've got one-offs that are occurring. Can you give us a little bit more information what's happening, not just down in the management of the southeast corner of the state, but what we're starting to see, even if they're one-offs in other parts of the state, which parts of the state those are?
Commissioner Meyer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fisher, thank you for that important question. It's important to never forget this. CWD is here, right? And we're continuing to fight it. We're doing the best we can, but we can't just think that it's in the background. It's in all of our management decisions that we make on a daily basis to a certain degree. We are finding some new deer that have popped up. We're trying to determine what may have caused those things, analyzing that. You may have recently seen that we're moving away from culling to a certain degree in certain spots because the prevalency rate has creeped up a little bit, or it may not be as effective. It's maintaining, but getting a little worse. I mean, we're holding our own, but we're seeing these one-offs pop up. We're trying to figure out what are causing those. Deer move a ton. We're doing a big deer movement study, doing a bunch of movement studies on surveys right now, working with others who are doing similar work, trying to determine that. But the war is not over on CWD, and we need to be as persistent now as we have been in the past on those activities and making sure people understand it, are aware of it, and are testing voluntarily wherever possible. Our mail-in kits have been extremely popular. One of the things that we saw, and it was related to a couple of those fines, is working with taxidermists. Last year, the legislature allowed us the opportunity to work with taxidermists to collect samples. Two of those samples that we found came from taxidermists that were from larger bucks that people brought there. So looking for opportunities to expand that network as well. It's really important.
Pete Fisher, you took that last question. I thought it was going to be left for me, but I'm glad you're covering it. It's an important issue. Continue with
you, Mark. Thank you, and I'll just be real quick on it. Is it'd be good to expand out. You know, when you're starting to see the one-offs, I'd like to know exactly where those are, you know, popping up, and it feels like we need to maybe start picking up, being a little bit more aggressive. Has the rollout of the quick test been very helpful? Is that starting to get used in a more widespread way to help being available for detection out there?
Commissioner Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Fisher, that still isn't an official test, so we're working with MinPro on that issue. But still, the really only verification is post-mortem sampling. So.
Commissioner Meyer, I just had one last quick question. Otherwise, I think we're going to be moving on to our next presentation with Bowser. But I, now in the absence of the CWD discussion, was interested if we're seeing any changes in hunter education numbers. There's been an ongoing conversation on new hunters coming into the sport, whatever it might be, taking advantage of the opportunity to bring home some meat for the freezer. So just curious if there's anything that you've noticed in terms of a trend there over the last few years, and if that's something we have to talk about offline later, that's fine. Just was curious. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, the numbers have been relatively stable. But let's definitely have a conversation offline on what you're thinking and how we might be able to pull something like that into the program. So it's still relatively hard to find a class. If you're looking for your grandkids or your children, I would look right now because they're filling up right now. I mean, I'm trying to get my grandson into one, so I know what that's like. But there's also other opportunities online and things like that. But, yeah, however we can expand that or bring more of an incentive in, let's have a conversation for sure.
I appreciate that. With six that have come through or are coming or about to come through Hunter Education, it's always been a bit of a challenge to try to get them to all of their classes, and it's nice to have the online option to get some of those hours squared away and get them ready to go for the field work and such. But we can chat about that more later. Not seeing any other member questions, Commissioner, so I think we will release you and give Bowser a few moments to get technology up and running. So members, there'll be a little bit of a pause. So if you've got a text message to respond to, now might be a good opportunity.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to say thank you for the opportunity. And it's really a pleasure to be here to work with you all. And I look forward to the work that we're going to do, the department, the executive branch, and this committee. And, you know, the way I view it, the way we view it is conservation is a red or blue, it's green, and we all need to work together to make sure that we can make that work. And I just look forward to doing that with you all, and I want to give you my commitment that the department is here to work with this legislature to make successful decisions. Thank you.
I really appreciate that, Commissioner Meyer. There probably has never been a more truer point in our history that we needed to work together on these issues with the divided legislature. So appreciate that, and thank you for your testimony today. All right. Director Jaski, if you and your team want to get set up. That hardly took any time at all. Please introduce yourself for the record as you begin your presentation, and I appreciate you coming in today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I'm John Jaski, Executive Director with the Minnesota Board of Water and Soil Resources, or Bowser.
Director, if you might pull the mic a little bit closer. That one's a tough one if it's not right there. Thank you.
Is that better, Mr. Chair?
That is much better. Thank
okay.
you.
I'll reintroduce myself. And John Jaski, Executive Director with the Minnesota Board of Water and Soil Resources, or Bowser, as it's commonly referred to. And with me is Assistant Director Andrea Fish. And so she was going to kick this off, and then we'll go through the presentation and take any questions whenever you'd like to take those on. Thank you.
All right. Assistant Director, same spiel. Go right ahead.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. For the record, I am Andrea Fish. I'm an Assistant Director at Bowser. Pleasure to be here with you all today to talk a little bit about our agency. The vision of Bowser is that all of Minnesota benefits from lands and waters that are ecologically and economically sustainable. Our mission is to work with partners to improve and protect Minnesota's land and water resources. We are an agency that has field offices statewide. Our governing board is the appointed 20-member board that includes members of local governments, citizens, and members of other state agencies. In terms of the actual administration at our agency, our staff size is about 150 when we're fully staffed, and we do our work in offices across the state from Bemidji to Brainerd, Duluth, Detroit Lakes, Mankato, Marshall, Rochester, St. Paul, and Waite Park. Our goal is to be as close as we can to the people we work with across the state. Our partners in terms of delivering our programs are the state's 88 Soil and Water Conservation Districts, or SWCDs, 45 watershed districts, and 87 counties. We also work with various joint powers organizations, state and federal agencies, various non-governmental organizations, and tribal governments. One thing that distinguishes Bowser from our partners at DNR is that our focus is on privately held lands across the state of Minnesota, which are about 76% of the state. Our local government system then gets our work, the programs that you fund, and the monies that go with those from the state throughout all of our counties, cities, watershed districts, and SWCDs for on-the-ground conservation results. The vast majority of funding that is appropriated to our agency leaves the door to go to local government delivery of our programs and practices. We know that many of our programs directly impact privately held land of all sizes. Farms are a big part of our agency's work, as well as utility corridors and residential areas. This map, of course, is showing Minnesota, and the orange shaded area of this is that privately held land that we are working with. A lot of farm country, of course, throughout the state of Minnesota. There are a number of statutory authorities and responsibilities for our work around various types of water planning and water policy, soil and water conservation district work, watershed, drainage, protection of state water resources, and soil across the state, too. Director Jasky and I are going to talk about a few areas that have seen some significant investment in the past couple of years or the past biennia, especially for members who might be new to the committee and less familiar with these. Please feel free to let us know if you have questions, of course, because we're happy to talk at greater length about these as we go. One of the programs that we've discussed a lot in front of the legislature in the last couple of years is our local government roads wetlands replacement program. This program is mandated by state statute and helps local governments plan their road projects that might otherwise impact, interfere, or interrupt a wetland area. They are required to replace those wetland acres, and we manage that at the state level so that there is a centralized and efficient process for local governments to do this when planning their road projects. We can provide something that is cost-effective and has expedited permitting by managing that centrally at the state. This is an area where we have come forward for bonding requests primarily in the last many years. This has been funded through capital bonding projects, but this is a big component of our work within the state agency at Bowser. So if you have questions, of course, we're happy to make sure that this committee is also informed about that program.
Director Jasky.
Yes. If there are any more questions, otherwise I'll continue on with a few more slides.
Go
Thank
ahead.
You. The next piece of this, and these are, you know, Ms. Fish described the wetland protection programs, and those are some mandatory and regulatory programs in their nature. We also have, most of our programs are voluntary, and you'll see a few of those highlighted here, soil health being one of those. Of course, it has a statutory foundation under it to work with, and this allows us to work with mostly ag producers, although you can do soil health practices, you know, on lawns and other things as well to make sure that those areas are able to, you know, hold water primarily as one of the main things and nutrients as well, and use that instead of having it run off into our lakes and rivers and streams. And so there's various ways of doing that. Obviously, it involves seeding, but then there's different ways to accomplish that. Sometimes it's done after the harvest in the fall. Sometimes it can be done during the summer in between the rows, if you're talking about a corn crop, for example, and then once the corn is harvested, the cover crops have a better start to accomplish their objectives, which, of course, are conservation-minded in the sense that it provides water quality, it improves the carbon sequestration in the soil, and in doing so, of course, also provides a productivity benefit to that cropland because now those nutrients are going to be able to be stored and used by the next year's crop. Now, making this all happen, of course, takes some technique and some equipment and certainly some assistance in many cases to help people understand how to do it. Then once they figure out how to do it, they often carry it on their own. In that regard, we have a soil health program that has been built with legislative funding from a couple different sources. Most noteworthy here is that we're also able to go after and seek federal funding with our federal partners. You know, the U.S. Department of Agriculture and Natural Resources Conservation Service has authorized a $25 million contribution to this work over the next 5 years. Now, some of those things are in a bit of a pause right now, given the federal transition that's underway right now. This contract has been signed, so we're hopeful that it continues. It's, you know, super practical kind of thing that we've got set up to do in coordination with their authorities and their resources as well. Another one of these voluntary approaches is water quality, water storage, and we, you know, looking at the landscape of Minnesota, a great deal of it has been altered hydrologically through draining and sometimes additional manipulation. And so we need that drainage. We need that infrastructure to help make sure that we can make our land productive and predictable in terms of utilization. But we also are trying to find ways to hold the water on the landscape in more concentrated ways. And here's just an example of that. When the water leaves the landscape, we can hold it in these retention areas. Some of them you'll see here is a larger one on the surface. Of course, there's lots of other ways to do that in a subsurface fashion. And a lot of these projects, they're not going to be real visible to anyone because either they're near a road or sometimes they're largely subsurface. You can see here we've also been awarded another USDA contract for $21 million to supplement the state funding that's been put in place. We started this program already with some of the state dollars, and we're awaiting the conclusion of that federal agreement. Hopefully that'll happen here in the next few months. You can see, the trend of additional water moving through the system. This trend here is indicated in that graphic for the Minnesota River, which of course is southern and western Minnesota. And quite a few large tributaries as well. Again, these projects can be of various scales, but all of them are designed to either slow the volume or to slow the rate of the water leaving the landscape. And of course, we often get some other benefits too, water quality being the primary one, but flood and infrastructure protection is important, as well as sometimes we can build habitat value into these as well. This is another category of work, again, voluntary in the sense that we're trying to provide help to landowners to establish on their own property plant communities that are going to provide public benefits. And you can see here we have three different categories of that. First of those, lawns to legumes is the version of it that is aimed at the backyards of residences. And you can see here that there's been thousands of projects installed, and of course all over Minnesota. You can see here that I think the data shows that we have projects all over in every county in Minnesota. And then once these are established, it's up to the landowners to keep them going, and they do that with help from the local soil and water conservation districts and others that can help with the upkeep and the technology that it takes to make sure they're working well. This is on a larger scale. These are, again, statutorily established programs, and this is a program, the landscape, which is a broader than a yard, but really looking at ways to establish corridors within communities, often using some of the public lands too, as well as the private landscapes to make the corridors for these benefits. Again, they're all voluntary. We have city park departments that have been helpful in this, private businesses as well. So this allows us to do it on a larger scale and connect those various patches together. And in a similar fashion, we work with utility companies. They have these corridors that, of course, for in this case, you see electrical transmission, but we also have other energy transmission corridors that are set up. And the utility companies have to maintain these, right, so that they aren't interfering with their infrastructure. But one of the things that they've shown an interest in is putting in species mixes that can provide some public benefits as well as trying to minimize their need to maintain the area. So if they can eliminate the brush cutting and tree removal, and there's some cost savings there, and getting in a plant community that will keep itself going pretty much by itself and provide those public benefits has been of great interest. Another part of the programs that we have are conservation easements, and these are larger scale projects in almost every case using a technique called conservation easement authorized in statute. Our Reinvest in Minnesota program is where that is authorized. Again, we use to every extent possible, additional funding from the federal government or others, but that has been a super successful effort to look at these lands that have been drained primarily and put the water back and restore the plant communities and the habitat and clean water benefits that go with that. Wetland restorations are the biggest part of that. We also do channel and other landscape work. The grasslands that you see around these wetland areas, of course, are also important for plant diversity and natural communities to thrive. We recently, just last month, concluded an agreement, or actually we expanded and extended an agreement we currently already had with the federal government on the Conservation Reserve Enhancement Program, or CREP. Some of you may have heard of the Conservation Reserve Program, the CRP program, which has been a federal program, a really foundational part of the federal farm bill. This provision allows states to enter into an agreement with the USDA Farm Service Agency to supplement their work with ours and put it together. And you can see here we've expanded that to include now additional counties, 12 new counties. You can see the dark gray counties here in this map are now included again in the option to enroll in this program. That includes now all of the counties in Minnesota that have more than 30% agriculture, because we're really aiming this at primarily at the marginal agricultural lands that have some other issues with productivity. We increased the acreage cap so there's more opportunities available for a longer period of time. And then the idea of also including an additional practice was something that we negotiated with the federal government to allow us to aim at properties that have a potential benefit to benefit private wells. We previously could do this, but only for the public well installations. So it would allow us to go in a broader way to some of those places where we need to protect private drinking water as well. And then we also were able to update the federal to state leveraging ratio, which is now at 7-3 or 70-30. So for every $7 that the feds have, and if we come up with three, we get those federal dollars coming to Minnesota. Another endeavor that we're working on and actually have worked largely through the first phase, and that is this transformation from geopolitical boundary-based water management to watershed-based. You can see here that, of course, we had in, you know, now 10 years ago, we had a county-wide approach to this, mostly through counties and soil and water conservation districts. And of course, we have watershed districts, too, which were always on a watershed scale, but they, of course, weren't everywhere in Minnesota. And this allowed us to use the science and the analysis that went from that data collection by the MPCA and the DNR, Department of Ag, Department of Health, et cetera, to use that information and put it into a plan of action to restore or protect these waters in ways that are science-driven. And so you can see here, this map shows those that have now been approved and locally adopted and are operating. And of course, the metro area is included in that. It's just called out separately here because of the seven-county metropolitan area has a statutory framework that's different. Has been in place since the early 1980s, and they have a watershed approach that's acknowledged in this approach, and they are also considered to be fully implementing, as they have been for at least now three decades. Just a few examples, and there's many hundreds or thousands of these projects that we see coming out of these plans, right, are about trying to either protect or restore those waters. Here's an example from the metro area, and we measure the, you know, of course, there's money it takes to build these projects, and the local partners set that all up, and then they target the work to identify the most pollution reduction or the protection measures, and you can see here each of these areas has goals, and each project has a progress towards a goal, and these are just some examples of that. In this case, you know, we're getting partway there. This is another one. This is up in northwestern Minnesota. You know, here this channel's being restored to put the sinuosity back, and this is a very popular way of accomplishing quite a few different objectives, right? You provide some dynamic storage in the stream because you now have a longer distance to travel that water. It drops the sediment out or holds the landscape together, the banks together better, and of course provides habitat at the same time, both habitat on the upland areas but also in the channel itself. Here's a couple more that we don't have the data on yet, but here's another one in the southern part of the Red River Valley. Again, the other part you get out of this, you can see this a little bit larger scale here from the sky view, because it obviously provides that benefit to the channel and the itself, but we also, as part of these designs, there's often a farmland protection measure included as well, which includes generally a small-scale berm or dike along these areas so that the channel does remeander, but not completely out of control, of course, and that gives those lands next to these areas some level of protection for their farmland, typically a 10-year flood event level, which is pretty important to allow those lands to be predictably farmed, as well as then getting the water quality and habitat benefits back. Here's another one that doesn't have a progress towards goal, because this is one that was involved in protecting something. It was a, in this case, it was a Serpent Lake in the city of Crosby. It was not yet impaired, but it had a trend of getting negative, more negative each year. And so rather than just sit around and wait for it to get on an impaired waters list and doing something about it, the community there, along with the Soil and Water Conservation District, figured out a way to design something that would keep that lake from getting to that stage of being impaired. Here you see something on the surface. That thing is no longer visible because that's a piece of installation of a water storage area that will go underground. And again, this lake, you wouldn't really even see most of these projects that have happened to improve it, but they're working and they're functioning, and it's important to invest in the areas that have, you know, threats of degradation. Sometimes an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, and this is a good example of that. And then finally, on the policy side, Mr. Chairman and members, we did a lot of things in the last couple of years to get some policy updates, including to the watershed district law and the soil and water district law and things like that. We just have one thing this year, and this is a consensus item that has come from the drainage work group around just removing a duplicative report to the agency about the status of the buffer installations along those public drainage systems. And we spoke with Representative Jacob this morning. He said he'd give it some consideration as a bill. So, Mr. Chair, members, we have that as our conclusion. Here are our contacts. I should mention that Mike Nelson, our legislative coordinator, is also in the audience, and he is always available as either of us to work with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Director Jaski. Representative Warwas, if you want to lead us off.
Yeah, I want to thank you for that. First of all, I just want to apologize. I've been under the weather, so my voice and my appearance are going to be a little bit skewed here. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for that. But take this in a little bit different direction. I'm the new guy here, Mr. Jaski, so I appreciate your patience. And I want to thank you for joining us today. How many Wetland Conservation Act determinations does the DNR process every year? I have a lot of wetlands in the area that I'm from.
Director Jaski.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative. So a couple of things. Let me just back up a half a step, if you wouldn't mind. You know, the Wetland Conservation Act is a component of one of those statutes that Ms. Fish showed, Chapter 103G primarily. And that protection measure is implemented by local governments, by counties and soil and water conservation district, watershed districts. They process those as a local land use decision, and if there is a compliance measure, enforcement measure, then the DNR is the primary option to deliver that conservation officer paperwork to the landowner about the compliance. So maybe I didn't answer your question completely, but I could continue to learn more about what you're interested in.
Representative Warwas.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I guess I'm thinking, and I'm on a different track than we've been traveling on, but as it pertains to, like, for instance, our permitting reform bill this year, talking about Wetland Conservation Act determinations, for instance, that get extended by, like, the 60 days allowed in statute. And I recognize that this is very different from our conversation.
Okay. Director Jaski.
Okay, yeah, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. Now that helps me to focus a little bit more. Yes, there is a provision in that bill, House File 8, I believe is a recollection on the number, that does require local governments to make a decision tied to another statute, which is Chapter 1599, that says that they have to make it within 60 days, you know, unless it's extended for cause, right? And that the basis for that cause is almost always seasonality. So you get an application in, you know, middle of October, and you have to do something on site, or you get it in November, and we want people to get them in as soon as they're ready, right? So if it requires an on-site review, they oftentimes need to make an extension because of the winter weather situation, but because soil and hydrology and the plant communities are things they use to evaluate those. So we've looked at that bill, and you know, our opinion is that we aren't quite sure what it's trying to achieve. I think we understand the concept of the goal, but I don't think the language as we saw it was actually going to accomplish anything different than making people wonder what the change was about. So we'd like to work with you and the members of this committee if it comes back on that.
Representative Warwas, any follow-up?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you. I guess I would like to know, and maybe it doesn't seem like it's a much used part of the statute, but if I could get some data on how many times that these extensions have been used, I would like to see that data.
Okay. Director, yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative, we at the agency don't have that because it's a local land use decision, but we can do a little inquiry and see if there's any maybe not perfectly statistically valid information, but we'll see what we can find about that.
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two questions, actually. My first is on lawns to legumes. This is definitely how my constituents tend to interact with Bowser. It's a very popular program, and my constituents have really availed themselves of it. I was talking to a local gardener who works at a nursery in my district and garden shop, and she said that she's noticed more and more interest and more participation, and even when residents aren't able to necessarily get this grant, they're still working to make their yards more pollinator-friendly. I know that this is a popular program. Have you noticed any increases or any changes as a result of this, like in terms of just pollinators generally in the state or any other kinds of trends for that you've noticed as this program has become more popular?
Director? Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative. We have a lot of interest in it, and we have a very long waiting list of people who would like to be participants in it. I think one of the key things to its success is not just the help with getting the plant material, but the idea of the design. So the participants actually go through a workshop so that they learn how to do it right and to do it, you know, for themselves, and then to take care of it too, because that's also important, right? So I would say that's been the most important part of it, and we've got some both people in the agency, but we contract a lot of it out with others, and of course, you know, the nurseries and so forth, which are also providing all the material, are often have people that can help with it as well. So there's a lot of, I'll call it, undocumented contributions from others that make this successful.
Representative Jordan, any follow-up?
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it sounds like a successful kind of public-private partnership. My other question, you mentioned something about new federal funding and grants that have been awarded and just questions about federal funding. How much of that is in the bank, and how much of it are we waiting on from the federal government? And then what would it mean to not receive that federal funding for Bowser's work?
Director.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative, the way it works for the federal government is nothing is in the bank because we actually have to spend it and then get reimbursed. So that's what the real question at this point is. And so of those two agreements, I mentioned three, so let me cover the first two that are much more similar. The soil health agreement is a contract with the USDA. That contract has been consummated, so we have a signed agreement for us to go forward and make the program work and then be reimbursed by the federal government. So that's what the status of that one. The one on water storage, we have an approved authorization for the application. We have an agreement that's been prepared. It hasn't been finalized, so it's very close to being finalized, and we're working to get it towards finalization, and so far that seems to be going. And then the other one was the Conservation Reserve Enhancement Program, and that one is a whole different thing where as long as the CRP program is working, which it right now is in a pause as well, not so much because of anything changing at the administration level, but just because of the Farm Bill itself, which needs to get reestablished or renewed. They extended it once, and now it's in a situation where they can't enroll any new members or participants in the Conservation Reserve Program. So we're waiting on that one. So they're all three a little bit different, but that one is more coincidental with time than it is to do with anything changing at the administration level in Washington.
Members, I have Representatives Finke, Jacobs, Purcell, Schultz, and Hansen. If there's follow-up, I'll come back, Representative Jordan. Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair Heinzman. Along the same lines, what percentage of the work that you will do, like what percentage of your work is funded through that federal funding? You mentioned federal funding several times in your presentation.
Director Jasky.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, it's most of those things are all about a supplement to a state program that we can get the federal government to contribute to. That's what those things that I was describing, all three of those. We have just one joint effort with USDA, which is a training program that we conduct for soil and water conservation districts and other local governments so that they can get the training that are needed to do these practices and projects proficiently and accurately. That, I think, is probably the only one that's got a, like an ongoing component to it. It's a cost-sharing agreement between the two agencies at the federal and state level. So they're all supplements, really important supplements, but they are supplements.
Representative Finke.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I know that, you know, $30-odd billion of the Minnesota budget is federal dollars. So these are, like, really important questions that we need to continue to ask about how our state's going to pay for these things. I know that some people think that these are distractions, but this is the money that we use to fund the state of Minnesota. So I would, if we ever find ourselves, you know, I mean, I've been doing some research on this, obviously, and funding freeze is really getting to states' environmental programs. So if you hear or see anything like that, I would really appreciate a report back to the committee.
Representative Jacob.
Oh, thank you, Chair Heinzman. So when I was on the Winona County Board, as part of the kind of the initial setup of the first One Watershed One plan when it was still in its pilot stage, and we were just appalled at that time by the tens of millions of dollars that this was going to take just to get the program set up, not for money that actually went for programs on the ground. Can you tell me to date how many dollars have been spent setting that program up?
Director.
Mr. Representative, we can get that to you. I can't, of course.
Could it be $73
million? Representative Jacob. Director.
Mr. Chair, I would say no, it is nowhere near that amount.
All right.
Representative Jacob, anything more on that?
Yeah, I think we had discussions when we first started. By the time we got through all the counties, and it's a large number, and that's all money that did not end up on the ground. So that was frustrating. Can you tell me also on that One Watershed, One Plan, so for the roughly more than half of the counties, or close to half the counties that are on the state's perimeter still using the state boundaries, how is that beneficial to spend that kind of money and then half of those counties are still using the same boundary they used to use?
Director Jaski.
Mr. Chair, Representative, you're right. I mean, there's a watershed boundary that we don't get to control on the boundaries of our state. However, there are a few places where that is orchestrated pretty well. Red River Valley being one of those. Of course, Red River, you know, bisects North Dakota and Minnesota, and of course goes into Canada. And so we have, you know, in that place, we have an international organization called the Red River Basin Commission that works across those boundaries to manage that watershed area on both sides. And we work with North Dakota, they work with us. We work with Manitoba, they work with us on that. So it's not like there's not an approach to that. Other places, it's not as formal as that, I would say. I know the St. Croix River, we have a similar arrangement with Wisconsin. But you're right, there is a geopolitical boundary that still has to be acknowledged, and I appreciate what you're pointing out.
One
Representative
question.
Jacob.
Thank you, Chair Heinzman. So when we adopted the One Watershed, One Plan, the approach was supposed to be better because it was targeted and measured. And previously, we were using county boundaries, and it was completely willing participation. So if a landowner has property that's not in the targeted and measured area, how does that landowner benefit from the One Watershed, One Plan? Mm-hmm.
Director.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, you're right. There is targeting, and targeting can be both geography, as you're describing. It can also be the kinds of practices that are done so that we're doing the things that are going to get the most public benefit out of the investment, right? That's the idea behind that. We believe that that's a better approach than, you know, waiting for just voluntary people to walk in the door, this allows us to go to them and still in a very voluntary fashion. It's 100% voluntary whether they want to participate, offer them some choices about what they can do or consider that will provide this public benefit. So I appreciate what you're saying about the maybe the cross-governance things are maybe a little more of an issue to pay attention to when you have multiple counties involved now. But I think it's still important that we use that watershed approach to figure out where to do the things that are going to give us the most public good.
Yeah. I could ask a lot of questions, but I'll let others have time.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Chair Heintzman. Other folks have gotten to questions about federal funding, so I'm wondering about the habitat-friendly utilities part. So I'm wondering about, I guess there's discussion around having these particular pieces of habitat be applicable to pollinators, but also to working lands and grazing, and I'm wondering if you have any insight or purview around that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Director Jaski.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative, it's a couple of things on that. You know, in the utility example, you know, I talked about the corridors a little bit too. We also, you know, have a lot of solar installations in Minnesota on private property. And one of the things that this program has also been able to do is to work with those, either the solar company or the landowner, to install pollinator species in and around those solar arrays too, because there's not much else you can really do in there. I've seen places where they, you know, at least talked about putting them up higher in the air and using something underneath for grazing and things like that. But, of course, that costs more in terms of infrastructure to raise the panels and what have you. So back to, on the grazing piece of it, we do allow grazing on some of those conservation lands. If there's a grazing plan that is put in place, it actually is a benefit to the habitat and water quality, right, so that they – because the animal, the disturbance actually benefits the species diversity, and the disturbance helps. You know, you got to, of course, know what you're doing. If you get too many animals grazing in too small an area, it can be harmful. But if you do it right, it can really be a conservation benefit.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Director Jaski. Just help me out a little bit here. I'm looking at the slide that talks about the CREP program or Minnesota CREP, and in particular it mentions that 12 new counties have been added. What's the process for counties to be added to that program? And, you know, three of those 12 happen to be in districts in the district that I represent. So help me understand that a little bit more.
Director Jaski. Mr. Chair, Representative, it's a process that two things, I guess. One is it takes the state and federal agencies to agree to that. We felt that it would be useful to have additional opportunities for landowners and local governments who are working with them in those areas. It previously was limited to the areas in the light gray back in 2015 or 2016 because those were the areas that had the greatest water quality challenges, but we also know that those areas that are in dark gray have some have those as well, groundwater being one of them. River Valley, you know, we also know about the challenges there with the, you know, wind erosion and things like that too that are additional to the things that were in place before. So basically the short answer is the state and federal agencies, after receiving input in a proposal that we submitted around to various interest groups and participants, decided it was a good idea to try and add some more counties, and that was the short version of it. Those areas also have marginal agricultural lands. It's probably the short fact about why.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate your answer. I just, you know, for the communities that I represent right there that were added, you know, the economic backbone is agriculture, and so I just I want to make sure that that's not going to create any disincentive from the economic backbone of the area. I know that you and I both share a lot of commonality in my area, and so that's why that just stuck out to me as a new addition, especially considering the amount of dollars that appears flow through these programs. Secondarily, different question for you. Can you share with us What is the interaction between your agency and the Sentinel Landscapes program surrounding Camp Ripley and what that management looks like?
Sure. Director Jaski.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, just on the point you made about the economic elements of conservation projects, I'll actually follow up and I'll share with the committee an economic analysis that was done by USDA in Fort Minnesota that showed that for every dollar that is invested in conservation across Minnesota, it generates, I think it was a 1.4 return on investment in those local communities because those dollars are, you know, used to buy materials, to hire contractors, et cetera. And so, and the conservation easement program is certainly one of those key to that type of work. So we'll share that with the committee. I think that's important. As Ms. Fish noted, our agency's mission is to make sure things are ecologically and economically sustainable. So, but your question about the Sentinel landscape around Camp Ripley, Minnesota, which is in Morrison County, which is my home county, and it is a partnership with the Department of Defense, another federal agency, that then brings funding to Minnesota to acquire voluntary conservation easements around the perimeter of that Camp Ripley military installation so that those lands aren't developed. They can still be farmed. They can still have natural benefits. But the compatibility of a National Guard base and development or high-density development nearby was of concern to everyone because that military base needs to be able to be there hopefully for a very long time. And that way they can be assured their mission is going to be able to continue, but without having to acquire land, via the Department of Military Affairs to accomplish that. So it's been a real win-win for both military operations and for conservation.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is just a quick follow-up on this. I just, my concern for, to make it simple, for both of these programs is that we're using public dollars to take it away from the mainstay of the economy locally. I understand that a lot of times, some of these instances, it gets returned back to agriculture. But there's a limit to which that's going to benefit the communities and the schools in my district. And so encourage a balanced approach that doesn't disincentivize agriculture.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And going back to the federal issue, so your partners are primarily Natural Resources Conservation Service, is that correct?
Director Jaski.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, that's correct.
Representative Hansen.
And Mr. Chair, and they're often co-located with SWCDs in each, in the various counties, is that correct?
Director.
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes, that's correct.
Representative Hansen.
So if they're laid off, I mean, is there any way that the state can pick up the tasks of the federal government, those funds or that staffing?
Director. Mr. Chair and Representative, there's no automatic version of that for sure. The Natural Resources Conservation Service, which is a primary agency of the U.S. Department of Agriculture that does the conservation work, there's a couple things. We, as I said to Representative Finke's question, we often work to supplement each other's work, right? As you noted in your comments or question, the offices are often side by side in the same building, working with the landowners, in often case the producers, egg producers, to try and find ways to build these projects and practices that work for them. I don't know what the actual consequence will be. We know that the information I received from the USDA and NRCS is that their staff who are in a probationary status were the ones that were laid off. So that means either new people that have been in place for a year or less, or people that have been promoted into a new position. And so they were already in a little bit of a deficit with their staffing levels compared to what they had been, so I'm sure that's not going to help. But I can't really comment any further about any of the federal stuff because I'm not in the middle of it. I'm just hearing it from them indirectly.
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, so you have a building. Now that person's gone or persons are gone, truck sits there, computer sits there, rent's no longer there, staff's no longer there. People are used to have folks working with them. You know, it appears that the decision makers, the unelected decision makers, the unemployed decision makers, the Musk decision makers that are deciding to fire people, look at whether it's probationary or unclassified or, my gosh, conservation. So I'm really concerned if you have not only the people gone, but the programs gone because decisions are made without any thought, no scalpel, just a sledgehammer, removing people and having the ripple effect where there'll be an expectation that we have to pick up that cost. And the consequence on the economy will be dramatic where we may not have the money to pick up those costs either. So those services contracts could be an EQIP contract, could be a CRP contract. Those are no longer there. The people who actually worked on the contracts to give the landowners money are no longer there. Huge consequences here of decisions made in a very short period of time. So I sympathize for you and your staff who are located with our federal partners who have worked on innovative programs that are recognized nationally as being effective, and they're just torched on a Friday afternoon. And the ripple effects are going to be felt for a long time.
Members, there are no other questions. I appreciate the time that Director Jaski, Ms. Fish, thank you for coming to the committee. Any last thoughts?
Mr. Chair, thank you for the opportunity to present to you. And again, to the point that Representative Hansen made, you know, one of the things that's most important about the way we deliver our programs is that we have to be local, right? Because people are only going to trust somebody they can go back to and trust again, and that's really important. So that's why our programs are delivered through local governments and those offices, and we hope to have our federal partner that can be there with us again in the future, just as they were. So thank you.
Members, that concludes our agenda. We are adjourned.